Writers, we are always quoting Jenny Nash from our sponsor, Author Accelerator, and this episode is no exception. Partway in, you'll hear Serena describe how Jenny asks authors to envision three different first chapters of their work, be it fiction, nonfiction, memoir, doesn't matter. She asks us to push ourselves to find three different ways into the story, and the third one is always the hardest and sometimes the best. Every week, I tell you how proud we are to be sponsored by Jenny and Author Accelerator, because we are. They do good work, whether it's matching writers with book coaches or training up those coaches to do the job right. If you've never gone and poked around their site, you should. Head to authoraccelerator.com/amwriting for the tools and tricks that will help you with what you're working on now.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone and try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause, and
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is Hashtag AmWriting, the podcast about writing. Cleverly named, isn't it? This is the podcast about writing all the professional things, or maybe the unprofessional things. Well, we try to be professional. Fiction, nonfiction, memoir, pitches, proposals, essays. What this really is the podcast about sitting down and getting your writing work done.
And I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 30-odd romance novels, and you can find more about me at serenabowen.com.
And I am KJ Dell'Antonia, the author of the novel How to Be a Happier Parent is not a novel, although some people have teased me that it is. So I'm the author of the book How to Be a Happier Parent, as well as the novel The Chicken Sisters, which is coming out in December, and therein lies a tale with which many of you are familiar. I am also the former editor of the Motherload blog at the New York Times, where I am still sometimes a contributor. And yeah, that's me.
Jess is off today, but we have an exciting guest. And our guest is the author of 25 or more books for children, from picture books all the way up to one of my favorite young adult novels that I've ever read, ever. Her name is Julie Berry, and I met Julie for the first time in, I believe, 2013, when she was giving a talk at a retreat I went to at the Vermont College of Fine Arts, which was given by their MFA program. And so welcome to the show, Julie, because I have been thinking about that talk for 7 years, and I finally get to talk to you about it again.
Oh, thank you so much, Serena. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, shortly after we met and after you gave this talk, you published one of my favorite young adult novels ever, which is called All the Truth That's in Me. And it's a historical novel that takes place in a fictional American town during colonial times. And so, of course, that was a beautifully invented world that I could see in my mind as I read the book. And as I look at your long list of accomplishments, there's a lot that takes place in fascinating places that I will never have a chance to go to. Like your very well-received novel last year, The Lovely War, is sort of a battle of the Greek gods that takes place during World War II. So there's just so much going on in your work. And when I heard you speak, I didn't know that that was true at the time, but this talk was about using visualization as you write. And it so impressed me that I wanted to ask you to come back today and give us a little refresher about what your thinking is around visualization and how you use it.
Well, thank you. I got my inspiration for that talk that I gave in 2013 in part from some readings that my sister had sent me. And she is today a doctor of mythology. She has a PhD in mythology. Her name is Joanna Gardner. And she was pursuing this doctoral program. And her special focus is on creativity and creation myths and the sort of connection between mythology and creativity. And so she'd shared with me some scholarly readings on the psychology of creativity and on the role that visualization plays in in developing our ideas and in sort of entering creative space. And I was particularly impressed by the many examples that she, well, that those sources gave of great legendary writers that we all know, you know, the sort of great names of the literary canon, and the many examples from their letters and diaries of their experiences with dreams and visions, you know, visions in every sort of sense of that word, right?
Right.
Ranging from sort of psychedelic experiences to trances and daydreams and just the way that their imagination worked in pictures. And I was really struck by that sort of atmospheric sense of images and places and skies and sunsets and stormy seas and curious and fantastical beasts and creatures and how those pictures in the mind informed some of the great classics that we still reach out to. I think, you know, the one example that leaps to mind was Mary Shelley and how a sort of image of Frankenstein's monster first permeated her consciousness and became the source for the novel Frankenstein and you know, many other examples like it. But so I was struck by how much images in the mind were the fertile source of great works that we know from the past, but also from this sort of juxtaposition of that with sort of more contemporary psychological research into how images in the brain and combinations, especially unusual combinations of things, lead to greater creative output. So for example, if you ask people to take, let's say, three random objects and combine them, or take two animals unlike one another and combine them into an animal in your brain, how this kind of activity that resides not on the level of words, but on the level of things that we could see or touch, and that our brains can replicate that seeing of the things, and that even that almost touching of the things, and our brain can really go to work and fire up and light up, you know, extra chunks of brain tissue to tackle those tasks of combining and juxtaposing things. So I feel like I'm already rambling. And this is only the first question.
Well, here's the thing. So what I got so far is that Mary Shelley is a genius, and it's totally hopeless for me, because what if my brain is super audio in its memory, like I think in dialogue, and I'm just a really analytical person who has never melded two animals in my brain. So like, how does a super cynical 2020, you know, author go there, like in a practical way?
I'm glad you asked that. I definitely don't think that we should take from this material the idea that visual imagery is the only source or the only channel that feeds their creativity, but that it is a sort of rich kind of taproot or, you know, oh geez, I haven't taken earth science in 1,000 years. One of the sources, one of the feeders into the river, right? One of the streams that merges.
Tributaries.
In. Tributaries. Thank you. My goodness. You don't use it, you lose it. So that's one, I think it's one important source. And I think the research would say you're a lot more visual than you think. Your brain works in images, your dreams work in images, even if you don't fully realize it. So that's one thing. But also, the great news from this research and from the science is that our brains can work in images on command. We don't need to be people who, you know, are sort of visited by the muses, so to speak, or by, you know, by any of the sort of mystical descriptions that we might use to describe the arrival of images in the brain. You don't have to be a prophetess. You don't have to be a mystic. You don't have to be a tripping. You can put those images in your brain experimentally. And so it's kind of funny because even before I'd ever read this material, I had been doing workshops with young people, like as a lot of writers for children do, and I'd sort of developed a little program. And in that program, I asked the kids to brainstorm a bunch of words, just a bunch of nouns, things, animals, people, objects, you know, just spit a bunch of words out. So that's a very verbal exercise, right? Think of words of interesting things. But right. If you run dry on words, look around you in pictures. So I would say, look around the classroom. What do you see? You see a picture of a hippopotamus. You see a pencil sharpener. You see a chalkboard. You see a backpack. You see a Twinkie. Or put yourself in an interesting place in your mind. Put yourself at the circus or the zoo or a shopping mall or a big city. Look around you. What do you see? Well, you see billboards and you see popcorn and, you know, you can put yourself in those places. You see people selling shoes and on and on. So when you've then got your pile of words, then I tell the kids, pick three at random and combine them in your mind into an idea. So that had been the sort of thing that I had done with young people. Then they get an idea, wacky idea, dinosaur, duck, blah, blah, blah. And then we, you know, try to think of characters and develop the setting and we're off and running. But what struck me in this material that I had read was that that's an exercise any of us can do at any time. And there are all kinds of permutations and ways in which we can, you know, draw a word out of the hat, open the dictionary, whatever, you know. But the power is in the randomness. And the temptation that we have when we are thinking of ideas is to always look for sort of what's the logical thing that we might find adjacent to. You know, thing one, what would logically be adjacent to it? What would thing two be? And what would thing three be? And what this research says is get away from that. The odder and more disconnected the three things or the two things or the four things that you work with are, the more creative space that opens up and the more fertile and the more inventive the results will be. So we should all be asking ourselves, how would I combine a lion with a frog? And how would I bring an accountant and a necromancer together in a story? Like we should be, you know, we should be training ourselves just as, you know, athletes train their bodies and musicians train their musical abilities and their bodies to produce music. We should be training our bodies, as in our brains, to practice creativity more by assigning ourselves exercises in combining random and dissimilar things and seeing what that produces. And what I have found is that it's been the source of several of my books. Those little exercises I do with fifth graders, I sometimes, you know, take a photograph of the whiteboard before I erase it, and I go home and file it away in my idea inventory, and sometimes I use it. The Emperor's Ostrich came out of one of those workshops. So,
wow.
So the great news is none of us has to be innately clairvoyant to tap into our brain's ability to become more creative through visualization exercises. Because while you're asking yourself, how do you combine a lion and a frog, you're going to see it. You're going to look at a lion in your mind, and you're going to look at a frog in your mind, and you're going to start making choices. And that's creativity at play. So we can do this anytime. We don't need drugs. We don't need to be alcoholics. We don't need to be, you know, chosen by the gods. We just have to do this work. That's good news.
Okay. It is good news. You reminded me a little bit of an exercise that Jenny Nash asked us to do once, and she's the owner of the Author Accelerator, and she's a coach that works with people who are writing books over a long period of time, and she will sometimes ask them to envision three first chapters for the story they already want to write, but like three different ones, like, and it's always coming up with that third one that's the hardest, right? Because you resist the weird result. But I'm starting to see how the weird result is maybe plays into your idea of how to unlock and make space for unexpected things in your work.
That's so interesting. I'd never heard of the Author Accelerator, but I think there is a real power in that, right? That third thing, push yourself further. You know, I tell people sometimes if you're trying to think of three things and create an interesting story, you could think of three things which are ballerina, ballerina, and ballerina, you know, three different ballerinas, but that draws a very small triangle of options, you know. But when you say, well, let's just say ballerina, accountant, and necromancer, that's a very big triangle, right? There's so much space in between there because those things are so far apart. And of course, this could sound gimmicky, and this isn't the only way that ideas arrive in our minds, and it's not necessarily always the way to produce the very best of ideas, but I think it is an exercise that just creates those synapses in our brains, those neural pathways that are less risk averse and more playful and more willing to be unexpected and more willing to explore the things that, you know, it's like Jenny Nash pushing you for that third idea, you know, get to that place that's maybe a little weirder. We can get more comfortable with weird the more that we do this.
Right. You also mentioned, I believe, at one point, drawing, and I know KJ likes to draw and is comfortable drawing, but drawing fills me with a certain amount of terror. So how would you use drawing in the middle of a book that you're writing to sort of, you know, unblock yourself for what happens next?
Sure. Well, I will right up front say I am not good at drawing. And you know, in the writing world, there's those of us who are good at drawing and those of us who are not. That's probably a gross oversimplification. But speaking as a representative of those who are not, I'm hugely jealous of those who are, because I feel like they, you know, they have such a power and such an ability to be visual in their writing. But I am not. However, I draw anyway. And this is super helpful when it comes to figuring out who my characters are. I draw pictures of them. They're ghastly pictures that will never be shown to another human being, but they still force me to picture things. Like, what is this person's hair like? And I can't draw it the way I see it in my mind, but I still have to think about that. And what are they wearing? What kind of clothing do they wear? What other objects do they wear on their body? What do they carry with them? What kind of tools are their tricks of the trade? What's their sort of signature thing, and what message does that convey about who they are to the world? What are they trying to say through their appearance? And what does their appearance say about their history? What does their appearance tell us about where they come from, or what they've suffered, or what they've enjoyed? And all of those questions are the kind of thing that they fill in so much, and they supply me with so much richness and individuality for that person that I do not arrive at when I don't follow that exercise. So my notebooks have all these, you know, really amateurish sketches of characters, but in the process of making them, I discover so many things about who my characters are, and I come to care about them more. And I also sometimes, you know, will draw diagrams of buildings or, you know, maps of a country. And not only does this give you information, such as, you know, where is the billiard room, but it even sort of sets a visual tone, right?
Yes.
Is this a whimsical kind of place? Is this a fanciful place? Is this a dark and mysterious gothic-y place? And I do not have the skill to render that for anyone else's consumption but my own, but I can still think about it as I draw my pictures.
When you were mentioning the mood idea, and actually after you mentioned drawing at one point, I let myself off the hook for drawing, but I did start to sort of clip pictures that reminded me of the mood I was trying to create. Mm. So, you know, it's kind of like a bad wedding Pinterest board that I end up with, but instead of place settings, it'll be, you know, I just wrote a novel that took place in a pie shop, and I cut out lots of pictures of bakeries and different pies and, you know, a cafe setting, just as like a shortcut for remembering how I wanted readers to think about the space. Mm-hmm. And just getting into like chapter 17 a little faster than if I didn't have that, because I really struggle with visuals, and I never describe anything, which, you know, people hate.
I wanted to write a story set in a pie shop. I never got around to it, but I won't do it now. Don't worry.
Oh, No, go right ahead. I'm sure I didn't invent it. There's a lovely pie shop in Vermont now. I don't know if you've been back recently, but in White River Junction, there's a place that only sells pie.
Ooh, I have not. I'll have to check it out.
I think there's room in the world for many, many books set in pie shops. Even arguably all the books set in pie shops. I think that'd be fun.
It would.
This year, all the books are set in pie shops. Next year, we move on.
I always say pie is the one thing I'm actually good at. So, but I don't think there's a way to make a living selling pie, actually. Like, for me personally, like, the economy of scale wouldn't work out. I couldn't make enough pies fast enough to, you know, be successful running a pie shop. So I thought I would just, you know, have a story pie shop. And
best of all worlds. Plus, you would quickly grow to hate it.
I think so, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the downside.
Books are a good place to dump all the careers that are things you love to do but would stop loving to do the minute you had to make money with them.
For sure.
Especially in romance. There's, you know, lots of books set in flower shops. And
right. All those impractical romantic dreams we have.
Yes.
The little cafe, the little flower shop. Well, I love what you said about Pinterest. And I have been using Pinterest more and more in the last few years than I ever used to, especially as I do more with historical fiction. I find that, like, for example, I'll make boards of faces and photographs of people from the time period, just because I think in some mysterious way that I can't explain, I feel like when I look into the faces of lots of soldiers who fought during World War I, that they come alive for me. And even though I'm not basing any character specifically after any specific photograph, I'm still getting a sort of collective sense of these were the people who lived and died then. And I'll make, you know, boards of, you know, young women who were alive at that time and look at the clothing that they wore, but also the expressions that they made and, you know, try to glean what those expressions can tell me about their hopes and their personalities and their notions of what was attractive and you know, all those things. And I wasn't really a Pinterest user prior to, you know, the last couple of years, but it's so helpful, you know, for faces, for places, for maps, and just I'll collect, you know, pictures of brochures and posters from the time and novels and newspapers and magazines and things that help me capture sort of their imaginative life as well as their sort of documented photographic reality. And all of that is so, so helpful. I have to say, this conversation is reminding me of things I need to be doing and giving me all kinds of super helpful, like, tips that I should have already known to fix problems that I face right now. So thank you for that.
That always happens, right? And if you really, if World War I is something you're looking at and not just a wonderful example, I hope you have looked into They Shall Not Grow Old, a film by Peter Jackson. Mm-hmm.
Do you know, I have not yet seen it. I need to. I want to. You know, when it first came out, I was still, I believe, working on Lovely War, or else it was newly out. And there was a part of me that was like, it's too close to home right now. So I wasn't ready to see it yet. But I certainly need to now. And I'm looking forward to that.
Well, I'm sure there's so many references about World War I, but he's done this thing that you were just describing, which is to take imagery from that time period and actually bring it to life. If listeners don't know the story of this film, he took all this old World War I footage and used technology to adjust the frame rate so that it doesn't look super fast. And he brought it into color. And then he, in some cases, used lip readers to discover what those silent films, what the people in them had been saying, to actually bring it audio as well. It's wild.
Wow. I can't wait to see it.
And, well, it's also just, you know, such an amazing and unreal example of doing this difficult thing that we've just spent 20 minutes discussing, which is to bring something you can't touch and bring it closer to life and to be able to really dig into it. Well, I have also been given so much to think about by this. I think your idea of drawing a floor plan is something I really need to get on, because then at least if I am terrified to draw a face or a nose or something, at least I can draw something in 2D space that makes me visualize my characters there.
And I think this is also sort of giving us an opportunity to think about how we layer our drafts. So if you're someone who is more visual, then maybe there's more visual stuff in a first draft, but maybe you don't have any sounds or any tastes. And to sort of go in, because what I really hear you saying is that those unexpected moments of your brain having to work harder to sort of imagine to imagine that sensation, those help a reader really find themselves and ground themselves in the story. So I feel like we could take the time to go through and do a draft and try to fill that stuff in. And if we didn't, you know, mention the character's blue hair or remarkable eyelashes the first time around, that doesn't mean we can't do it. You know, we can have another chance.
Absolutely. And I will say, you know, not only, you're right, it does help ground the character, it does help the character see what we've been seeing, but it also prevents a multitude of sins. And I'm always amazed at how taking the time to draw a floor plan or a map or any artifact or object that's important to the story, how that exercise exposes the sort of creative cheats and shortcuts that we all are guilty of when we're first conceiving of a story. You know, we are very mushy sometimes about the streets of the city or the distances between things or whether or not it would actually have been possible to, you know, for person A to see action Z, you know, from where they're standing. And not only do you catch a lot of logical impossibilities, but you discover a lot of fascinating possibilities as you actually plant yourself in the space of the world, as you actually understand that when you open the closet door, you can see this, but you can't see that. And so I think, you know, we talk about trying to create realism and I'm, you know, a sense of reality. I like to use the word verisimilitude, right? Because what we're doing isn't real. It is an invented product of the mind that is, you know, transmitted through words. But I think the more that we visualize both the sort of wondrous, like the scales and wings on the dragon and their pulsating eyes, but also the incredibly mundane, like, you know, 7 steps down to the basement and you'll bump your head on the water pipes, those details bring a place to life. And those weird details about the mole on the cheek or the, you know, musty scent of mothballs, they bring a person to life. And the rich reward of taking the time to do that work is that your stories, your places, and your people feel so much more real to you, and therefore they feel so much more real to the reader. And when they feel more real to you, I think it is actually easier to tell their story. You know, you're not just kind of groping in the dark and trying to create people and places that will cooperate with your overall plot plan. You're actually in it more. So it's got more of the pleasure of reading a great book, but you're writing it, not reading it. But you're so immersed in it from a sensory perspective that you become more of a journalist and less of an inventor.
And that would be such a pleasure, right? If you felt you were recording the truth instead of struggling with the next little bit. I love it, Julie. Thank you so much.
Me too. This is really fun.
It is. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Before we talk about what we've been reading, and our guest, Julie, has been reading gobs of books, let's talk about what you're writing and where you're writing it. Have you checked out our newest sponsor, Dabble Writing Software? Serena and I gave it a try earlier this year, and we are total Scrivener converts. Dabble is easy, intuitive, available everywhere, and has a super distraction-free interface, as well as the best online take on moving a bunch of post-it notes or index cards around that we've ever seen. Your manuscript is always all together and compiled, and at the same time, always all split into scenes or chapters in a way that's easy to navigate. Go to dabblewriter.com for a free trial, and please let us know what you think. All right. Now we get to talk about what we have been reading and usually what we have been loving. So these are probably books that do exactly what we've been talking about, which is make the places and people that are in them come to life, whether they're fiction or nonfiction. And since you're our guest, I am going to let you kick us off. Julie, what have you been reading and liking lately?
Well, this pandemic has sort of created more space for reading, which is one of the nice things, I guess. It feels a little odd to say, you know, that there's a nice thing about the pandemic. There isn't. It's only tragic and horrible, but I guess maybe there are some silver linings, a little bit more times available in the day. So one thing I've been doing lately is sort of revisiting some of the young adult fiction that I read when I was young and how it kind of got me started in this direction imaginatively. I wasn't aware of the term YA when I was a teenager, and I wasn't really aware of there being a large body of works for teens. But I did read The Witch of Blackbird Pond, and I read a lot of books by Robin McKinley. I read Beauty by Robin McKinley, which was her first retelling of Beauty and the Beast, and also The Blue Sword and The Hero and the Crown, which I'm reading right now. And another book, which I would have loved as a teen, was around, but I wasn't aware of it, that I discovered later, is called The Perilous Guard by Elizabeth Marie Pope, and it's G-A-R-D, not G-U-A-R-D. So guard is an older English term meaning castle, so The Perilous Castle, basically. So I've been revisiting some of those classics and being sort of transported back to my own adolescence through reading them sort of following the contours of how they create a really richly rendered historical romance for teens, and how they encapsulate really sort of strong female characters and strong messages about young women's capabilities, but also, you know, looking at them through the eyes of a, you know, 45-year-old woman instead of 15 and a reader in 2020 and not, you know, 1985. Or I guess 1989 or thereabouts. And so that's been really rewarding, really rich. I'm also reading The Secret Life of Trees right now, which is just the antidote needed for the sort of chaos and turbulence of the moment we're in right now. It's like been the most soothing read possible. Since I can't really take a walk in a forest where I live right now very easily, this has been amazing. And then on a sort of more researchy nonfiction perspective, I've been reading. So one book I've really loved, and I've talked a lot about it online, is Black and British by David Olusoga. And this is just marvelous. And I've also been reading Staying Power, The History of Black People in Britain by Peter Fryer. And it's been just an extraordinary experience. These are both really broad and deep dives into a sort of longitudinal study of racial dynamics, both in Britain and in the British Empire, tracing, you know, the origins of enslavement of Africans in the New World right up to the present day. And that's been just fascinating. So that's been, wow, that's been on my bedside stand as well.
Lovely. Well, I spent this last couple nights reading a book that I think I need to return to KJ, called Love Lettering by Kate Claiborne. And it is women's fiction or a romance or both, but the love lettering bit is very literal in this case because the protagonist does lettering professionally, like calligraphy and all kinds of hand-painted lettering like you might see on a sign.
So there's a lot of, you're right, it is my book, and there's lots of visualizing. Like there's lots of here, you know, this is the part of this sign that caught my eye, and this is the part of this sign that caught my eye, and this is what I'm doing with this chalkboard. So yeah, lots and lots of putting you in place.
And there's crossover between verbal and visual, which is really germane to our conversation. When somebody shouts at the heroine, she sees it in all caps, basically.
Yeah. In like a special font, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. So it's a really neat book about that crossover, and I enjoyed it very much.
And I have just been enjoying a nice, fun piece of... I kind of like the genre of crazy private school parent fiction. This one's called Tiny Imperfections, and it is about a woman who works as the admissions officer for a kindergarten of a K through 12 crazy private school in Silicon Valley. She's doing the admissions as a kindergarten person at the same time as her daughter is graduating and doing her college admissions. So those things are crossing over. She's also the token black in this place, and the narrators are very open and really talkative about sort of how that's affected her whole life. And it's a different, it's such a narrow perspective on it that it makes it really interesting, if that makes any sense. There's it's only this one person, and it's this one character's experience, and it is that. Like, it doesn't try to be, and this is how all persons of color or all people in this position would feel about it. It's just how this person feels about it, which is the best. I mean, it's how a novel should work. So that is Tiny Imperfections. And it has two authors, and I don't remember. I mean, I remember that they are Ollie and Asha, but I don't remember their last names. But it's been all over the place. It's pretty fun, and we'll put it in the show notes.
Cool. Wonderful.
All right.
Well, once again, we would like to thank Julie Berry for joining us on Visualization. And if you haven't read All the Truth That's in Me, you should get on that right away. And I'm looking forward to her new one coming called Wishes and Wellingtons. It's a middle grade novel about a London boarding school for upright young ladies. And I cannot wait.
Thank you both so much. Thank you, KJ and Serena. This is actually the conversation I needed today to get me out of some ruts. So I don't know if any of your readers will, or sorry, your audience will benefit, but this is what I needed. So thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
I think they will, and I know we did. So this was awesome. Everybody, if you want to tell us what you thought or how you feel about visualization in your books, or how you're using these kind of techniques in a memoir or nonfiction or a novel, head over to the Facebook group, where we are always hanging out and always chatting and trying to work together to make this writing life thing work. And okay, Serena, you want to take us out?
I sure do. Until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Thank you.